Well, friends, today we're continuing our series in Mark's Gospel, and in today's passage, we'll see that Jesus is God's Son with God's authority, and that all our hope and devotion must be centered on Him. Now, friends, I wonder if you agree that we live in a highly regulated society, a society full of regulatory bodies which authorize certain activities, like registering your car, or getting a permit to build a house, or to hold a street stall, or to register a corporation. Regulatory bodies have power to grant authority or to withhold authority. If they grant you authority, you go ahead and do whatever it was you wanted to do. But if they don't, then you shouldn't. So if I'm extending my house and my neighbour doesn't like it, then he or she can challenge me. They can say, "What authority do you have to do that extension?" And then I just show them my building permit to prove that I have the authority for the extension. Well, friends, today in this passage, we meet people who are very interested in seeing things regulated, in seeing things are rightly authorised. And they'd fit, I think, very well into our highly regulated society. These are the chief priests and the scribes and the elders in verse 27, and they confront Jesus walking in the temple. Now, these three groups, the chief priests, the scribes and the elders, were the three groups who made up the Sanhedrin. And the Sanhedrin was in charge of the religious life of Israel. And these guys had a particular interest in the temple, which was the centre of Israel's religious life. And it's likely that this group of chief priests and scribes and elders who accost Jesus here are a delegation acting on behalf of the whole Sanhedrin. And they're really annoyed. They're annoyed with Jesus. So remember what we saw last week. So last week on his way into Jerusalem, we looked at the fact that on the previous morning, when Jesus was on his way to Jerusalem, Jesus cursed a fig tree for being fruitless. Then he'd gone to the temple looking for good spiritual fruit like prayer and heartfelt worship, but he'd found nothing of the sort. He'd found only corrupt profiteering. The place had become a den of robbers. So Jesus had caused a commotion, overturning tables of merchants and driving them out of the temple. In a sense, Jesus judged the temple for being spiritually barren, just like he judged the fig tree for being barren. And the cursing of the fig tree caused it to wither away at its roots. It was a goner. Its days were over. And friends, in the drama of Mark's gospel, we readers are meant to understand that the fruitless temple and the fruitless distorted religion practiced there is likewise a goner. It's withered. Its days over. So that was the judgment that Jesus brought. And it's no wonder that the heavies of the temple, the Sanhedrin, are angry with him. So they confront him and they say in verse 28, "By what authority are you doing these things? Or who gave you this authority to do them?" So they're basically questioning Jesus' credentials. Who does Jesus think he is doing these things? And the things they refer to are primarily Jesus' dramatic actions in the temple the day before, the overturning of tables, the driving out of merchants, preaching the temple as a den of robbers. But these actions were only the climax of a series of other things that he'd done throughout Mark's Gospels, things that likewise angered the religious leaders. Things like riding into Jerusalem on a donkey, on a colt, as if he were the Messiah. Things like presuming to forgive sins and welcoming tax collectors and sinners and redefining the Sabbath and preaching against the elders' traditions. These things were what annoyed the Sanhedrin. So the priests and the scribes and the elders asked Jesus for his credentials. By what authority does he do these things? And in a sense, it's not a bad thing to have credentials. And regulating bodies who approve credentials are actually a good idea. So for us, they protect us, the public, from shysters and from quacks. But regulating bodies who accredit people and give them credentials can have a dark side. They can be self-serving. So years ago, Julie and I were staying at a hotel in the city, and at the pool we met a doctor who was in Melbourne to sit exams to become a specialist in a particular medical specialty. He was having a swim, but then he was going to go back and hit the books again. But this guy didn't really expect to pass the exam, because he said only about a third of people actually do. You see, the particular College of Medical Specialists argued that by keeping the bar high, they were safeguarding the public. But our friend that we met at the pool noted that, surprise, surprise, by not letting many people pass the exam, they also restricted the number of specialists in that field. And the fewer the specialists, the more they're in the demand, and the more demand, the higher the fees. And so it goes. So regulating bodies, important for protecting the public, can easily become self-serving. And the religious leaders here, these regulators, are indeed self-serving. These religious regulators, they haven't granted Jesus authority to do these things, and they're upset about it. And when they interrogate him, at first glance, Jesus seems to respond like a politician facing a tricky question. And we're used to that, and we'll probably get more used to it between now and the state election. You know how it goes. The politician evades a probing question and doesn't answer. Instead, he or she asks a question of the journalist to throw them off. But friends, here, despite appearances, Jesus is actually not doing the political thing. He's not trying to avoid scrutiny. He's actually using a technique common to the rabbis. They often answered a question by posing a counter question. So he says, I will ask you one question. Answer me, and I'll tell you by what authority I do these things. Was the baptism of John from heaven or from man? Answer me. So here, Jesus is basically asking them where John's credentials came from. Who gave John his authority for ministry? Jesus isn't avoiding the question, because a serious answer about the validity of John's ministry would lead to clarity about Jesus' ministry. If his opponents get John right, they'll get Jesus right. Correctly answering Jesus' question about John's ministry will point to Jesus' identity as the greater one whom John preached about in chapter 1, verse 7 and 8. John himself had said in John chapter 1, verse 29, that Jesus was the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. And it was during Jesus' baptism by John in Mark 1, verse 10 and 11, that God proclaimed from heaven, "You are my beloved Son, with you am I well pleased." So in posing his clever question to the religious leaders, Jesus is actually setting a trap for them. And they realize this in verse 31 and 32. We're told that they discussed it with one another. Here they're having an internal powwow where they strategize to get out of the pickle that they're in. And they really are in a pickle. They don't discuss what they really think about John's ministry. They don't discuss their convictions regarding John. They just resort to strategizing and politicking. What will happen if we say this? What will happen if we answer that? So in verse 31, we read, if we say John's baptism came from heaven, he will say, why then did you not believe him? But shall we say from man? They are afraid of the people, for they all held that John really was a prophet. These guys realize that whichever way they answer Jesus, they're condemning themselves. If they agree John's baptism was from heaven, then they're shown to be rejecting God since they didn't heed John's ministry. And especially they disregarded John's testimony about Jesus and the fact, which they undoubtedly would have heard of, that God's very voice identified Jesus as the Son when he was baptized by John. On the other hand, if they say John's baptism was no more than man-empowered ministry, they'd put all the people offside, since all the people believed John was a prophet. That is, the people themselves believed John's ministry was from God. So the religious leaders are trapped and they refuse to answer Jesus. They say, verse 33, we don't know, which is not really true. These religious elites must have had some suspicion about John's ministry and its origin, since all the people, the religious plebs, if you like, understood him to be a prophet. When they say, we don't know, they're lying. Because if they acknowledge the divine origin of John's ministry, they'll be forced to acknowledge Jesus, the one to whom John's ministry pointed. They'll have to acknowledge Jesus as Messiah, and they'll need to radically change. So they lie. We don't know. And in response to this calculated lie, Jesus refuses to answer them. He won't specify by what activity he acts. But instead, he tells them a parable. And in it, Jesus actually does get at who he is, and therefore where his authority comes from. So he starts in chapter 12, verse 1. A man planted a vineyard and put a fence around it and dug a pit for the winepress and built a tower. Now, friends, here Jesus is speaking to religious establishment, and the scribes especially were experts in the scriptures. So as soon as Jesus mentions a vineyard and its owner, these guys would remember Isaiah 5, which Simon read to us. They'd know Jesus was talking about God and his people Israel. You see, God is the most devoted of vineyard owners, and Israel is his vineyard. And God does everything for his vineyard to make it fruitful, like Jesus mentions in verse 1. And in Jesus' parable, the owner entrusts the vineyard to tenants. And this sort of tenant farming was very common in Jesus' day. Now, if the vineyard in the parable is Israel, then who are the tenants? Well, friends, they're the leaders of Israel, leaders to whom God's vineyard is entrusted, including leaders of Israel right down to Jesus' day, including these chief priests, scribes, and elders in front of Jesus. And in the parable, eventually the time comes for the owner to receive his cut from the vineyard's produce. And for a new vineyard, you'd normally be waiting for 5 years. So the owner here has been waiting patiently for 5 years. And in verse 2, he sends a servant to the tenants to get the fruit that is due. But these tenants in the parable behave horrendously in verse 3. They beat the servant, they send him away empty-handed. They sound a bit like some of those tenants from hell that are stories that you sometimes see on A Current Affair or other shows like that. But in the parable, the owner's very persistent, isn't he? This owner has many servants who actually have a very hard gig. One after another, he sends them to the tenants. Some are beaten, some are treated shamefully, some are even killed, and still the owner gets no fruit. So friends, according to the parable, God, the vineyard owner, sends servants to Israel's leaders, the tenants, repeatedly. And the question is, throughout Israel's history, which messengers did God send repeatedly to Israel? Well, the prophets, like we saw in Jeremiah 25. But of course, Israel's leaders didn't listen to the prophets, rather they mistreated them. So much so that Jesus himself describes Jerusalem in Matthew 23 as the city that kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to it. So friends, by this stage, the religious leaders Jesus is speaking to are really feeling the heat. They can see that Jesus is picturing them as those who reject and kill God's prophets, like the tenants killed the owner's servants. But in verse 6, we're told the vineyard owner has one more to send to the tenants, But he's not a servant, he's a beloved son. And according to the law, the son, as heir, had a legal right to the land. The servants never had that right. They were just messengers of the owner, and unfortunate ones at that. So what's the owner to do? He's sent all his servants, and they've been assaulted or killed. If he sends his beloved son, will the same thing happen to him? Or will the tenants recognize the legal right of the son and give him what's owing? Well, the owner in the parable weighs up his options in verse 6, and we're told finally sends the son. He reassures himself, perhaps not convincingly, perhaps naively, he reassures himself, they will respect my son. But he overestimates the tenants. What do they do? Well, they have a powwow together in verse 7, like the chief priests and scribes and elders had in chapter 11. They plot and conspire, which is not surprising since the tenants represent these corrupt religious leaders. So in verse 8, the tenants kill the beloved son and throw him out of the vineyard, not only to avoid parting with some of the crop, but to keep the lot, to keep the inheritance for themselves. But it's worth stopping there for a moment to ask, who is the beloved son? We know the vineyard owner is God and the vineyard is Israel, and the tenants are Israel's leaders, including these leaders confronting Jesus, and the servants are the unfortunate prophets. But who's the son? Who's the beloved son? Well, we've heard this expression, beloved son, twice already in Mark's gospel. In chapter 1, verse 11, at Jesus' baptism, and in chapter 9, verse 7, at Jesus' transfiguration. And both times, the voice of God speaks, and God identifies Jesus as God's beloved son. So here in the parable, Jesus is saying that just as the prophets were mistreated and killed by Israel's self-serving leadership in their day, so now in his day, he too, the beloved son, will be killed by Israel's current leadership, represented by these leaders in his face. In fact, Jesus had predicted, of course, that's exactly what would happen back in chapter 8, verse 31, where we read, he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and the scribes and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. But the question is, will Israel's corrupt, morally bankrupt leadership get away with it? Well, according to the parable, no. In the parable, the vineyard owner destroys the tenants and gives the vineyard to others. So God will destroy Israel's self-serving leadership. He'll destroy those represented by the priests and scribes and elders, and he'll give the care and nurture of his people to others. And who are these others? Well, friends, they're the apostles, those whom Jesus especially chose to be with him and whom he'll commission to care for his people, his sheep, as we read in John 21. They're the apostles whom he'll commission to make disciples from all nations, Matthew 28, so that many more people will be added to his people. So, friends, the fruitless ministry of Israel's self-serving leadership will indeed be overthrown. And the centre of fruitlessness, the temple, now a den of robbers with its withering roots, will likewise be overthrown. Like the fruitless fig tree, the temple's days were numbered. It will be destroyed, as Jesus later says in chapter 13. But, friends, the fact that the temple will be destroyed doesn't mean that there will no longer be a temple. You see, in chapter 12, verse 10, Jesus quotes Psalm 118. He says, "The stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone." And here, friends, Jesus is saying that the beloved son of the parable, killed and rejected and thrown out by the tenants, will yet be vindicated. And here Jesus is identifying himself, the beloved son, also as the stone the builders rejected. You see, Jewish interpreters before Jesus' day understood Psalm 118, verse 22, as a reference to David, the youngest son of Jesse. This young son of Jesse was initially rejected as Israel's king in 1 Samuel 16. But this rejected son eventually becomes king, Israel's most famous king, the head of a dynasty. Though he was a stone the builders rejected, David became the cornerstone of the nation. And friends, likewise, Jesus, though rejected like an unimportant stone by Israel's current leadership, would go on to become the cornerstone, the most important foundation stone in God's new building, God's new temple, made of people, which is the church. And how would Jesus be rejected? Well, ultimately through his death on the cross. In his death, the old fruitless temple is rendered obsolete, and in fact the curtain of that temple is torn in two, as we read in chapter 15. And in Jesus' death and resurrection, the cornerstone of the new temple is laid, Jesus himself as the cornerstone of that temple. And this new temple is the people of God belonging through faith in Jesus, belonging to God. And this people includes others, including Gentiles from outside national Israel, as well as believing Jews. This reconstituted people of God, this temple centered and founded on Jesus, is entrusted to care the care of others to the apostles. It's not entrusted to the scheming religious authorities of the old temple. Believers in Jesus are like living stones being built into a living temple founded on Jesus, the cornerstone. And we read that over in 1 Peter chapter 2. So the religious leaders had confronted Jesus, demanding to know by what authority he did his ministry, and Jesus refused to tell them directly. But friends, in this parable, he's clearly shown them who he is and where his authority comes from. That he's God's beloved son who's come in judgment of their fruitless, futile religious games and in judgment of the fruitless temple, which under their watch was a den of robbers. Jesus has come with God-given authority to rescue all who'll trust in him, making them a new temple built on him as the cornerstone. And supported by others, the apostles, who according to Ephesians 2 verse 20, make up the rest of the foundation of the temple. Well, friends, the priests and scribes and elders are plotting and scheming, but they're not stupid. They know, verse 12, that Jesus' parable is against them, in judgment of them, and so they want to arrest him. But they leave him because they fear the people. In fact, if they'd taken Jesus into custody at this stage, no doubt to mistreat him, probably to kill him, they'd have indeed showed to all the people that they're exactly the wicked tenants Jesus spoke of. So friends, in this passage today, we've seen that Jesus is God's son with God's authority, and all our hope and devotion must be centered on him. But practically, what will that look like? Well, one thing it'll look like is to make sure that's where our trust is, that our trust is not in our religious performance, that our trust is not in having been part of the church for all our life, not having been part of the youth group for all our life. Our trust, friends, for our salvation must be personally in the Lord Jesus Christ and in his death on the cross on our behalf. But also as a church, as part of God's vineyard, we together should be growing and bearing fruit. God, friends, God doesn't want us to stagnate. He doesn't want us to be fruitless in our knowledge of him. He wants our faith in Jesus to show itself in fruit in our lives, in greater love and obedience to him, in loving costly service to others, in the church and outside, and particularly in sharing the great hope of the gospel with those who have no hope, with those who have false hope, those who don't yet know salvation through Jesus. But also this passage has a message, I think, to those of us who are elders and leaders in the church. As leaders, we're to be people who remember our responsibility. The church is God's temple. It's God's vineyard. It belongs to God, not to us. Leaders in the church are just farmers, just tenant farmers, called to look after God's vineyard, God's people. We're to serve them, to serve God's people, not serve ourselves, and we're to encourage and exhort God's people in their love and service to him.